This is my journey, inspired one story at a time. A library of leaders was created. It began as a journey to learn. As time went on, it began to grow. All it needed was a platform, and this podcast was created to listen, to inspire, to share. I am a storyteller, and this is my journey. Welcome to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. I am your host, Steve Anderson, and today our guest is Alan Murray. Alan is the president and CEO of Empire Blue Cross Blue Shield, an Anthem company in New York State. Alan is a great leader, somebody that has a lot of great lessons to hear in this podcast today. It's really fortunate to get him on the show. He's had experience with multiple companies, United Healthcare, Anthem, and now with Empire Blue Cross Blue Shield. He also started a Care Connect insurance company of his own and was the president and CEO of that before he went back to Empire. In today's episode, we talk a lot about leadership and what it means and leading through a pandemic, obviously. What we've learned from that. It's just been, tough on everybody. And he's somebody that grew up in the United Kingdom, came to the United States, has done extremely well, and now is at the top position of Empire Blue Cross Blue Shield. I think you're really going to like the episode today. I think we got down to some real in-depth things relating to leadership and leading people, and I think you'll enjoy that. I do apologize for whatever reason. We do have some connection difficulties in the show. Hopefully it will not be too bad. We'll see how it sounds. But if there's some cracking and some sporadic issues there with the connection, I'm sorry about that. I'm not sure what it was. Alan and I said we can just blame it on COVID, so why don't we do that? But anyway, enjoy the program. It's a good one, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Alan, welcome to the program. It's great to have you today.
No, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for thinking of having me on.
Absolutely. How do you get into the insurance industry, and what has your path been to get to your current position?
Well, Steve, I'm actually laughing as you say that because I'm probably the only person who can say my mother-in-law's best friend's cousin got me a job interview and I ended up in the insurance industry.
Okay, that's a good story.
But going back way before that, I was actually an officer in the British Merchant Marines for 6 years. And during that, I bumped into a wonderful American girl doing a semester of college with the Ithaca London program. I happened to be in a drinking establishment, which sailors tend to do. And I found this American lady there. And a few months later, I became her permanent souvenir. And that's how I ended up in the country.
That's great. That's great. So how do you, you're the president of Empire Blue Cross Blue Shield company, and that's a large company. How do you stand out and ascend to a leadership role in such a mammoth-sized company like that?
Steve, I think that's a great question, and it's multifaceted, right? I can't say that there was a particular destination that, from 2002 when I came to this country and joined Empire Blue Cross Blue Shield actually as a project associate, that I was going to say, hey, I'm going to stand out, I'm going to do the following, and I will be here in, 2020. My career has taken on, multiple different things. And I think first and foremost, especially as somebody is a little younger in their career, it's about management. It's about taking accountability. It's about creating order out of chaos and just trying to weigh up, all the different things that happen to be going on in a company. For me, that's kind of how I began my ascension into management roles and to kind of vice president roles. And I also was somebody who was never really, I would say, satisfied either with the status quo, or if I did reach a particular satisfaction with the status quo in a particular job function I had, I began looking for another challenge. And so it took me from, 5 years at Empire, where I left as a regional vice president for provider network. And I went to United Healthcare. I spent 5 years there. as you know, and I'm sure you'll probably have questions on it, I went and started my own health insurance company, Care Connect, here in Long Island, New York, with the Northwell Health System. And then full circle, came back to that company I started with all those years ago as the president and CEO. So I don't think per se it's been I've stood out on a continuous basis. I've just gone and found challenges that needed leadership, needed thinking, and perhaps needed a cultural transition.
Well, how would you describe your leadership style? If I were to say, you know, what's Alan Murray's style in leadership? How would you describe that?
So I think there's probably a number of different words that come to mind. The first one I would say is incredibly passionate. So I tend to find a personal objective and then try to transfer that and inspire others around that objective. And for me, at least for, you know, I would say the majority of my career in healthcare, it has been about simplifying healthcare or trying to get people to a healthier state of mind. And here at Empire, I've said, listen, we're going to measurably and materially improve the health of every single New Yorker. And so you might say, okay, well, that's a great kind of tagline. But from a leadership perspective, it's not a tagline. It has to be a belief system. And then you have to rally everyone around that. At the end of the day, though, that's the beginning of the culture. And as a leader, you have to promote other leaders so that you get a leader culture. There's a great book out there called Turn the Ship Around. And in it, it talks about a submarine commander back in the late 1990s who knew everything about this particular type of submarine. And his first command was going to be on this submarine. He ended up going and he was just about to be posted to this submarine. And they made a last minute decision, posted him to a completely different submarine he didn't know anything about. It happened to be the worst performing submarine in the U.S. submarine fleet. 6 months later, it was the best. Why? Because he had no other choice than to trust his leadership team and then to give them the control, teach them the competencies to avoid chaos. And that leader mentality is probably how I would describe myself. I'm not in the approval business because then I take the accountability away from those leaders who work with me. I'm in the provide an ability to reflect, provide ability to train leaders, provide them the tools and the resources they need to make decisions.
So leader's job is to grow more leaders. I totally agree with that. That really resonates well with me. What do you do inside your company to make that happen as opposed to just say it? What programs do you have? And as a new professional in your company, what could I look forward to help me learn and grow as a leader?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I don't think there's any particular playbook that you could roll out and say, hey, if you follow this within every single company, it's going to work because the circumstances of all companies are different. That being said, I think there's a number of themes that you need to follow. The first we kind of talked about, and that is setting a mission, right? At the end of the day, you need to have a group of leaders. In fact, you have to have a group of people, right? Not just, I mean, there's a leader in every different level of an organization, but regardless, you have to have a group of people that ultimately believe in that mission. Otherwise, it doesn't matter how skilled you are at a particular job or a particular task. If you don't believe in the mission, then you're going to have to get off the bus. Secondarily, you need to have a culture where people can do one of two things that I think are absolutely vital. Number one, they have to be able to think out loud, right? So no one person has all the answers. And so thinking out loud encourages others to become part of the solution. But at the same time, the second thing you need is you need to have a culture where you can have what I call controlled conflict, right? So again, no one person has the answers, and you need to introduce debate, discussion, and conflict in order for a group of leaders to rally around what is in essence a coming together to make a better decision. So that's the cultural part of it. You also have to sit down and provide ownership to those leaders. And so, for example, here at Empire, I think I'd been here about 6 months, so this was early 2019. we sat down as a group of leaders and leaders leading leaders and created about a 350-page five-year business plan that described everything we planned on doing over the next 5 years to implement and succeed at our mission. What did that do? Well, it created ownership. So every single person in the organization, every single leader now owned that business plan and allowed us to rally together in order to achieve these results. So that's how you start off. There's a number of other tactics along the way that I use that keeps that flywheel turning and that momentum going.
That's great. When you look back over your leadership journey here, do you have a particular mentor or a particular coach that you think made a big difference in your development?
Yeah, it's funny, Steve. I've thought about that, and I would say the general answer has been no. There are probably one or two situations, though, that have impacted me personally and driven me. I would say the first one was I was a pretty average student in like high school. I was captain of the football team, real football where you kick the ball.
Yeah. Football, okay. Just, we get it. We get it. Okay.
I don't know. Someone out there will say, well, wait, we kick the ball in football, American football too. Okay. We'll debate that at some point. When I went into the Merchant Marines, I found my calling. I realized I was actually pretty good at the subjects and the practical application. And so a light switch turned on in my head. And what did that teach me for kind of my career was you got to find that passion. There's no point just kind of cruising. You got to find something that really drives you. The second part, I think, of three that really changed me was it was actually in 2000 where I had kind of spent 6 months with my then girlfriend, who would ultimately be my wife, and I was going back to sea for the first time, and I was really struggling with separation from her. And I happened to go back as a third officer on a very large ship, and the captain at the time realized that I was underperforming and sat me down and had a conversation with me. It wasn't autocratic. It wasn't disciplinary. He said, what's going on? And I explained to him how I was struggling. And his response was, well, if you really care for this person, i.e. my future wife, then you're going to have to provide for her. In order to provide for her, you have to really focus on work so that you can do the right thing. And number one, you've got a lot of teammates, shipmates that rely on you. And what did I take from that from leadership? Leadership's about human connection, right? It is not about requiring people to do something. It is about understanding what drives people, what motivates people, and being able to link that to a purpose. And so I carried both those lessons with me. But what really made me a leader and where my mentors come from is actually from reading. I am an absolute avid reader, mostly nonfiction books about other companies and about other leaders and other people's inspirational stories. And my philosophy is if I only rely on the people I know, I may have 10, 20, 50, 100 influencers. But if I read, then I have thousands of influencers. And to me, that's where real mentorship comes from, the ability to absorb other people's lessons, reflect on them, and then apply it in your own way.
Now, you brought up one of the books about the submarine captain. What are some of your other books that you just talked about that are your favorites that our listeners could consider looking into and reading themselves?
Sure. Yeah, I would say one of the books that's made the biggest difference in my life is a book by Tony Hsieh. And he wrote Delivering Happiness. And it's the story of Zappos. I'm sure everyone out there knows Zappos, now owned by Amazon for a number of years. And they started as a shoe company, right?
Right. I got
that. And within that book, yeah. Well, I think most of us get it now.
Yeah.
Literally. I think I had a big box show up at my door the other day, and I just stared at my wife for a long time. But the story of Tony is fascinating. That wasn't his first company. He actually built a software company that he sold before Zappos to Microsoft. And he says in the book, the reason he sold it was while it was successful, he lost control of the culture. And he no longer thought that that company was the type of company that represented him as a person. And so he sold it. Ended up making a lot of money off of that, by the way. He then found Zappos, as it was, and he actually poured a lot of his money into almost all of it into Zappos. But what he built was not a shoe delivery company. What he built was a customer happiness company. And his entire modus operandi from that book was, I am going to make people happy. Yes, I'm delivering people shoes, but by the way, shoes make people happy. But I'm going to do something completely different from the retail industry. I am going to be there for the customer. And he had numerous examples and a number of hiccups along the way. But ultimately, Apple was successful because they do everything in their power to care for you as a person. And there's a couple of examples in there. Number one, their longest call they had to their call center is about 9 hours. And that was considered one of the most successful calls they've ever had because the customer left happy, even though it took 9 hours. And apparently what happened was he was ordering a pair of bicycle shoes, you know, the ones that clip into the actual pedal. And the customer service agent said, where do you go biking? And 9 hours later, he had basically described every biking tour around the world he'd ever been on.
Oh, wow.
I actually had a personal story after that one. My wife had returned a pair of shoes, but we had lost the box they came in. And this was around the same time, so it really anchored it for me. And my wife called them up and said, listen, you know, we've lost the shoe box. And they said, oh, well, we can't take it back. Oh, well, don't worry about it. Send it in anyway. Rules are made to be broken. My wife ended up talking about another pair of shoes she was looking for. It was a pair of tennis shoes. 3 days later, a gift showed up from Amazon, and it was a practice tennis net, rackets, and balls, just because they wanted to make us happy. I mean, if that's not a lesson for everyone out there, then I don't know what is.
Yeah, that's quite a company. I actually got the real honor before they sold to Amazon to tour their headquarters in Las Vegas. And just walking around, you can definitely say that people that worked in that company were happy. They were just couldn't wait to show you what they were doing and how they were doing it, and right. Just embraced you coming into their company and kind of like saying, you know, how cool is this? It was quite an experience. Yeah.
So that's definitely top of my list. There's so many out there, you know, Team of Teams, which is a book about, you know, the U.S. military and the kind of Iraq al-Qaeda times and how they adapted and really pushed down decision-making into the local teams, the local squads, because by the time information had gone all the way up to command, decisions had been made and come all the way back down again. The world had moved on, al-Qaeda in this scenario, and they were losing the war. So, again, I think it goes back to your question, Steve, on, you know, mentoring. The world is full of mentors. It's about how you use them and, you know, how you self-learn around that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, speaking of customers, as an insurance company, do you look at are your customers the providers that provide the healthcare, or are they the members that you have that sign up for your product? How do you distinguish those two, and how do you look at those two groups?
Yeah, I think insurance is one of those fascinating industries where the word customer means so much. And I think different people and different entities within health insurance use the term on and off for different aspects of what you just said. So I would definitely say our customers, you know, first and foremost, are the people who buy our products, right? At the end of the day, they're the ones paying the premiums or paying the service fees. And the vast majority of that is employers. At least from my perspective here in New York, you know, we have about 4 million members, commercial members, that they are purchased their healthcare really through their employers. So that's the first, I think, level of customer, because, you know, if I don't sell the product, any other definition of customer doesn't matter because I wouldn't have a business. We also have individuals who buy those products, whether it's on the individual exchange or whether it's Medicare or whether it's Medicaid. Although, obviously, on the last two, the customer is also considered the state or federal government. And then, you know, from a provider perspective, the providers are equal customers, because without their partnership, again, I wouldn't have a product to sell. I wouldn't be able to impact my mission. So I think the definition of the word customer is incredibly wide in health insurance. And they become not just customers, but, you know, essential components of the overall industry and business we run.
And when you look at those customers, you know, there's so much in the news and the media and personal experiences about healthcare and how it's provided and how much it costs and whatever. It seems like keeping those customers happy must be a paramount job for you and your fellow leaders in your company.
Yeah, it's very difficult. You know, I mean, I think if we think about the customer as the member, you know, the consumer of healthcare, it is difficult to keep them happy or satisfied with the product. You know, in general, those members don't call their insurance company to say they had a great interaction. I had a wonderful visit with my provider today. They usually call us because something's gone wrong. And so that definitely makes customer service a greater challenge because you have to get that person to neutral before you can get them to happy. And that can be difficult, you know, especially since we all know health insurance is and healthcare is an incredibly complex industry. In fact, if you think about it, we have our own language, right? Copays, deductibles, medical necessity, in-network, out-of-network, EOBs, charges. I mean, it's, you know, it literally takes a career to be able to understand all of this. So we don't make it easy. That being said, you know, one of the big things that obviously health insurers are responsible for is affordability. And I'll be honest, I think we have not done a great job of advocating our role within the healthcare society. But it is a vital role because, you know, there is a lot of overutilization. There is a lot of uncoordinated care out there. And one of the main functions of us as an insurance company is to make sure all those different pieces connect appropriately and people have the ability to make the decisions on the right data. And, you know, that is definitely something that would be otherwise be missing from, I think, any country that has a healthcare system that's remotely like ours. So, you know, the question is definitely not an easy question to answer. It is complex because our industry is so complex. But going back to the leadership question, that's where it takes, you know, leadership. It takes some risk in order to get the reward. And sometimes you got to take a leap of faith as a leader to invest and or to, you know, go down the paths of partnerships with certain entities in order to test new ways of doing things.
And as you know, many of the listeners on this podcast have ties to the physical therapy profession. And if we can all agree that physical therapy is the low-cost provider in musculoskeletal disorders, and early intervention of care with a PT has been proven to help to avoid some surgeries, less medication, less of a chance for that person to become a chronic pain patient, then why is there so much resistance from third-party payers to pay for that physical therapy as a first line of defense for their members?
That's a great question, Stephen. Listen, I am a big beneficiary of physical therapy myself. I'm pretty sure I spent, well, I at least went through my entire out-of-pocket max last year, if not just on physical therapy, then on the combination of multiple different things. I had actually had my bicep repaired, and I ended up getting frozen shoulder recovering from the surgery. I'm actually an amateur boxer as well, so I think I overhealed, and it was a physical therapist that got me back to getting myself in the ring so that I could break my nose again.
Okay, so great. Frozen shoulders are no fun, that's for sure.
Oh, it was brutal. That was a rough few months. But, you know, the answer again to that question is very complex. You know, healthcare is not within your typical supply and demand curve. You know, where for many other products, obviously the supply and demand curve, we all know, we've heard about it, you know, more demand, more supply, less demand, you know, higher demand, less supply, and so forth. That's not really the case with healthcare. In healthcare, what I think a lot of evidence shows is the more supply, the more demand. And if you build it, they will come. And it's one of the reasons why we have so much utilization. So what does that mean for physical therapy? Well, it means there is a tremendous amount of physical therapists out there, and there remains a question, is everything that that physical therapy is doing, and any other provider for that matter, appropriate? And so what insurance companies obviously do is we have rules, we have, you know, benefits, we have limitations in terms of what can be done without prior approval. Because quite honestly, there is a lot more utilization than there probably needs to be. I'll actually give you an example. It's called the, we used to call it the Blizzard effect. And I'm going to go way prior to COVID. Here in New York, when you would have a blizzard, obviously the elective surgeries were canceled for that day. On average, between 50 and 80% came back. So somewhere between 20 and 50% of those surgeries never came back, ever. And so you have to ask, why were they happening in the first place? And so what we obviously have to do is, because there's so much volume out there, is, you know, we have these various rules and regulations. And so coming back full circle to your question, Steve, is if you're a physical therapist, what do you do to stand out, to really show value above and beyond your peers that will allow insurance companies like myself to say, hey, this is where you should go. We should build programs that get you into a physical therapist before you commit to having that lower back surgery, you know, before you commit to having, you know, tendon surgery. Is there something we can do that allows that to happen? And unfortunately, the onus comes back to the physical therapist to really promote and say, hey, we have a new idea, we have a new approach.
And do you feel like within your company that you know who those high quality excellence providers are, you know, other than just looking at a utilization chart? Do you feel like you know the providers well enough to be able to make that determination?
I would say not as well as we think. You know, we have a lot of reviews on episode treatment groups and other criteria, but ultimately I would say the answer is partially, but not as sophisticated as obviously we would like it to be. I think there is definitely new technologies out there we're looking at. There is, you know, whether it's artificial intelligence or machine learning that is improving our ability to scope this and understand it, but it's not at the point where we can kind of pinpoint and say, okay, this is it on all these scenarios. This is the physical therapist that makes the difference. Not yet.
And how did you have physical therapists that come in and talk to people within your company to tell them what they're doing new and differently, or at a high level of excellence, or do you don't have that much contact with physical therapists?
So generally, I would say no. Generally, I would say there is not. There has been very few times in my career where, you know, a physical therapy entity practice has come in and said, here's why we're better. And not just from whether quality scores and saying, hey, you know, we do shoulders better because of X, Y, and Z, but actually showing the longitudinal cost of care. And, hey, we've prevented these many surgeries. We've gotten people back to work quicker. We've done X, Y, and Z, and really been able to show that end to end. And I will admit, that's probably incredibly difficult for your average physical therapy practice to do. But in the inverse of that, nobody's come in and said, hey, can you share the data with me so I can understand how good or how bad or how I compare?
Yeah, that's fair. How do private insurance companies look at, you know, Medicare for all, as you know, politicians and people talk about it? Is that a threat to your companies, or do you work within that? How do you perceive that idea?
Yeah, you know, it's a fascinating question, Steve. And you know, I kind of go back to, there is tremendous value from insurance companies and the way the American health care system is established. Listen, I came from the national health system. I happen to think that in general, and one can question the affordability of health insurance, health coverage in this country, it is a very good system. It has great doctors. It has great access. Is it perfect? No. But then I don't think any system is perfect. And I think there is an absolute role for, you know, private insurance companies here. And the way that, you know, employer benefits and incentives are provided, And so, listen, I try not to comment on politics or plan for politics because there's so much unknown. I personally do not think Medicare for All is a solution that will work. I don't think it works perfectly in other countries. And I would rather advocate for an improvement to the current, our current industry. And I think if we had bipartisan and industry professionals in a room, we could figure out exactly how to improve the current system and to make it, you know, better and more affordable for all.
So do you think this country, are you saying that this country is probably going down that road, that it's going to be a Medicare for all, or probably the better way to say it is a universal, you know, coverage for all? Is that how far out are we on that, do you think?
I'm going to plead the fifth on that one, Steve. Okay. Not because I don't have a strong opinion on it or not. I just think that there remains a pretty long runway before our country is ready to go down that path. And I think there's a lot of folk out there that, you know, continue to believe in the system we have. So we will see.
Okay. What's your biggest challenge each day when you show up to work to lead?
Oh, that's a great question. I would say the biggest challenge is ensuring that the momentum continues. And that's both the, a self challenge as well as a challenge for individuals. I think we all, it's almost like going back to my naval days. It's like you're on the ocean and sometimes you're in the peak and sometimes you're in the valley. And you need to make sure that you can put your own oxygen mask on first in order to rejuvenate yourself, to be able to go out and lead. Or if it's not a particular leadership position, maybe lead your peers or have the energy to tackle tough challenges. And I think a lot of people forget about putting their oxygen mask on, right? They forget that there's a reason why when you got an airplane and you listen to that safety protocol, they say, if you see the mask drop, put it on your face first, because if you don't, you'll be dead and you can't help anyone if you're dead. And I think that is that's analogous to life. We as human beings, as leaders, have to make sure that we are energized first. And it takes a tremendous amount of self-reflection to study yourself and know what it takes in order to build that energy and keep the focus and keep pushing, right? Because if you're not pushing, that ball is going to roll down the hill a lot quicker than it takes to push it back up again. And so from my perspective, I think that's an ongoing challenge that there is no global solution for, because as appropriate, every single person out there is different.
Yeah. I guess what I'm sitting here thinking as on the provider side, I think I understand how tough it was, or still is, in this pandemic, dealing with COVID-19 and all that it brought to our borders and all we're dealing with on the human level. But what happened in your company, and did you feel like you were prepared or unprepared, and what challenges have you had to deal with during this crisis?
Yeah, so Steve, I don't think anyone could say they were prepared, right? I think I wouldn't even say as a society in this country, but I think any society anywhere in the world was not prepared for this. Excuse me. And so preparation for this is less about preparation for COVID-19 and more about preparation in general. And I had been somewhat fortunate. I had rejoined Empire, 18 months before the pandemic hit. And so I had a chance to lay the foundation for my own leadership style, my own approach, lay the foundation for Empire's mission to materially and measurably improve the health of New Yorkers, to bring in leaders or to promote leaders and to change that culture. So we may not have been ready for a pandemic, but we certainly were ready for challenges. And so I think that's probably the number one secret sauce, is having built that allowed us to be incredibly agile as a company. And so when the pandemic hit, two things really stood out for me. Number one, is we went virtual. 99.9% of our company went virtual overnight almost. We shut down our offices across New York and we went virtual overnight. And I would say probably within 2 days, we were fully up and running with almost no impact in terms of the way we operated. And it was because of that foundation. And we sat down as a team and said, okay, now we have to be incredibly prescriptive with our communications. What do I mean by that? Well, if you're in a physical establishment, right, which almost all of us were for decades, for generations, it is those generations, those decades where your culture, your kind of subtle culture in a physical establishment builds up. And so you can predict and understand when you walk into somebody's office, when you knock on the door, the water cooler conversations and so forth. That doesn't exist when everyone overnight goes virtual. And so you have to create this very prescriptive approach. For example, scheduling coffee breaks with people who you may bump into in the office, because otherwise you're never going to bump into them in a virtual environment. You're not going to schedule a random interaction. And so I would say that was the first part. And then number two, I personally, with our, you know, a number of our government affairs people and our lobbyists, began immediately to work with the governor's office, with our regulators, in order to begin thinking through our role within the pandemic. What is a health insurance company's role and what is Empire Blue Cross Blue Shield's role, including a lot of follow-up care for those, you know, who were diagnosed with COVID, perhaps have been hospitalized and were trying to get back to life afterwards. We ended up creating a program for that here at Empire in order to help people get back to their day-to-day lives, which were very different. Again, that could happen because we had built such a great culture and leadership team in order to handle the day-to-day, even though that day-to-day had changed. So I think the moral of the story is leadership, culture, mission, all of the things that really make a company's heart beat are the things that are going to prepare you for the challenges and the disasters that may come up.
Yeah, you know, you make a really good point of having some time to develop your culture and get ready in that sense. I do know of two CEOs that unbelievably got handed the reins to their companies in January of this year. And you can only imagine. You can only imagine what that's like. So that's crazy. Do you actually live or work in the city in Manhattan?
So I live in Long Island. I'm out in Syosset and on Long Island. But my office before we closed it down, and it remains closed as a result of the pandemic, was at 14 Wall Street. So I had the better part of an hour and 45 minute commute each way, which sounds pretty rough, but I didn't mind it so much because I got to get, that was the time where I got the better part of 4 hours of reading in every day. So I made use of it.
So what do you think New York's ever going to be the same? How's it going to be different? Do you think your office setting is going to be different? Or is it too hard to predict at this time?
Well, it's definitely too hard to predict, but I have some thoughts. You know, I do believe that a couple of things really stand out as a result of what we've gone through. Number one, in New York, it's amazing as you walk around to see how society has adjusted. And I think that really shows the integrity and the adaptability of New Yorkers. And I think you see that in other parts of the country where, you know, ultimately it's not about the one, it is about the many. And you know, whether it's social distancing, whether it's face masks, whether it's hygiene or whatever it is, it did not take long to adapt. And so I hope that memory never leaves us. You know, we're in September, and September always reminds us of obviously what happened in the terrible day of September 11th, 2001. And I think for many, the same memory and the same ability to come together to overcome has stuck with those in New York. And this is yet another example of how we can adapt. That being said, we're going to struggle as a society for months, if not years, as we recover from the economic impact. And so we are required to change. We have to change. I think that society who is now wearing masks and is socially distant will take time to come back to a physical office environment. And I think we need to acknowledge that that environment will be different. A lot of people have found working from home works. And so how does your office environment become inclusive for those who are not there and are remote and those who are there? Because that is a barrier I don't think technology has overcome right now. So the answer is I don't know, but I know that there are going to be a whole host of challenges that we're going to have to work through.
And as you described earlier, I can tell you're a relationship builder and you believe in that human connection to collaborate and do things together.
But definitely the part I miss the most. On that note, I had a wonderful corner office when I joined Empire again in 2018, September. And about 6 months later, I got rid of it, turned it into a conference room and built a coffee table in the middle of the floor. And that became my office. Two reasons. Number one, I wanted to promote that thinking out loud, and I wanted to be out there and be kind of part of the team and have people realize that, you know, I'm approachable and I need them to approach in order to solve problems. And number two, it was really boring sitting in a corner office. Yeah. Nobody comes and talks to you.
Yeah. What advice would you give to a new professional that, maybe sees you and admires you and sees the position you have and they want to emulate that and they want to, you know, build a career similar to yours? What do you do as a young professional to move forward in that direction?
Fantastic question. I think first and foremost, you have to be prepared to self-learn. You're going to leave college, you're going to leave some sort of professional education, and you're going to go into the workforce. And there's a realization pretty quickly that it's tough to apply all of that kind of theoretical knowledge. And so learning is about on-the-job learning. It's about learning a skill. It's about learning, you know, the way people do things. It's about studying humanity. It's about understanding how people interact. You know, it's about understanding how people are accountable for things. You know, the shadow that you cast and how people are always watching that shadow. You know, it's about understanding diversity and inclusion and realizing that you need multiple different backgrounds in order to make decisions and improve society. And so I think early on in your career, you have to be a sponge. You have to be incredibly passionate about something, which we talked about it, and you have to be a sponge. Don't be afraid to ask for clarification. Don't be afraid to ask questions. Don't be afraid to admit you may not know something. I think with those things in mind, your young person who has that is ready to spring both into leadership positions, but more importantly, into making a difference in our lives.
Yeah, great advice. You know, there's always that concern too about, I even hate using the word, but the, you know, kind of the work-life balance. So, what advice do you give people to not let that get out of whack?
Yeah, you know, that's why I kind of mentioned earlier about putting your own oxygen mask on first. You know, work-life balance is something that takes a lot of reflection. You have to know what's really important to you. I've had the absolute fortune to be lucky. I have, obviously, I talked about my wife, Sharon, and my kids. I have three of them relatively young, and it's really important for me to be with them and to experience and teach and be part of their lives, especially obviously the kids from the teaching perspective. But it's also really important for me to spend time with me. There are things I like doing. You know, I like working out. I mentioned I was injured from boxing. I like boxing. You know, I like, you know, round of golf. So there are things that make me who I am as well. And it's important that you understand who you are and what gives you the energy. Listen, there are people that like just being at work and doing that. That's okay too, as long as it's a conscious decision. In the virtual world right now, I'm, you know, an absolute advocate of asking people to have a real disciplined approach to being on the computer, you know, to being on WebEx or Zoom, that it shouldn't become your life. And you need to really reflect on what that is. So I'll give you an example. I get up at 5:30 in the morning. I work out for a couple hours. I usually start my work day proper around 8:30. In the middle of the day, if time permits, I try to go for a run, or I'll walk the dog, or I'll try to do something different in order to re-stimulate my mind. And then hopefully by 7 o'clock at night, I can turn that computer off and I can go back at it. Now, that does mean I may have to catch up a little bit on weekends or so forth, but I know what's important to me. And my advice to those out there is make sure you know what's important to you so you can appropriately reflect and prioritize. You cannot work, if you want to give work 100%, you cannot work 100% of the time.
What do you think businesses, the biggest challenge is going to be in the next 5 years after what we've just gone through? And, you know, you talked about, you know, working at home as a part of this, but what other challenges and what other things are we going to have to just really figure out how to do better?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the remote world is definitely a challenge we're all going to have to face. And I don't just mean, you know, telecommuting, working remotely. I mean, I also think within our industry in healthcare, the onset of remote monitoring, you know, personal emergency devices, Apple Watches, and just this host of ability to monitor things and, you know, and self-review things is an industry within an industry that we haven't quite figured out how to harmonize. And so I think the challenge of a highly digitized world with just copious amounts of information is going to be a challenge, number one, for consumers. Like, what do you do with that information? Do you trust the information? How do you make sure you don't get taken advantage of with all that information out there? And then how do employers, how do businesses out there manage all of that? How do they manage the consumer's expectations? And so I think that's a big challenge for us. It's not just an industry challenge. I think it's a societal challenge. And it will begin rapidly to, you know, interact with every piece of our lives. It's something here at Empire and at Anthem that we're very heavily focused on, is the ability to, you know, put out digital devices, digital tools to interact with our customers, our providers across the board to try to assure them that the use of data, the tools are there and they're as sophisticated as they possibly can be. But it's an ongoing challenge, I think, in every walk of our life right now.
And you talked about learning and growing. And if we can agree that we probably learn more from our mistakes than our successes, what's a big mistake you made and what did you learn from it?
Yeah, I've had a few of those. And I think probably for most of us, you know, studying your mistakes is uncomfortable. It's really uncomfortable. And a lot of us don't take the time to study our mistakes. We tend to say, hey, I know what I'm good at, and everyone look at what I'm good at. But, you know, to your point, it's easy to focus on the success because it makes us feel good. And I think as human beings, we tend to edge towards what makes us happy. But, you know, definitely the failures or the mistakes are the ones we learn from the most. For me, you know, there's a number of times when I have believed I'm right. Steve, most of the time I am right, by the way. That's what I tell my wife.
Yeah.
But I believe I'm right, and I will go full steam ahead, and I will prove I'm right regardless of who I knock over on the way. And it took me a number of years to realize that, you know, that's not the best course of action. And hey, maybe I wasn't right. You know, maybe there are other opinions, or I'm only partially right. And so, you know, that comes back to, I think, somewhat maturity, perhaps, somewhat self-reflection, and being able to understand probably the way that you can interact and, you know, meet challenges as a group together. And so my approach is, I wouldn't say softened, but perhaps become more sophisticated in how I interact with people and how, you know, I try to bring them on board and invite their opinion and kind of work with them in order to get to a better solution than simply driving head on into it.
Alan, usually at this time of the interview, I ask a common question to my guests. And that common question is, in relation to leadership, What is a pearl of wisdom that you could leave us with today?
I would say the number, there's two really, really important parts of leadership, but ultimately they're the same. They're the same thing. And that is reflection. A real leader reflects and reflects on themselves, reflects on how they go about being a person, on what inspires them, what makes them tick, what gives them energy, reflects on what they did in the last month in order to understand where their expectations and what actually happened, did they meet, reflects on what went well, and most importantly, why things went well. And to your prior question, what didn't go well and how could you improve it? If you don't spend time reflecting, and that can come in the form of reading books, it can come in the form of discussions with others, I would say that you probably are not a leader at heart. You may be a really good manager of tasks, but without reflection, I would question the term leadership and its application.
What book is on your nightstand that you can't wait to get into?
I actually have three.
Okay.
Well, four, actually. One is a little bit of a history for me. I keep the Seaman's Guide pocketbook of the international regulations for preventing collisions at sea on my nightstand, which is probably what most people would just laugh at. But there was a time in my life where that was front and center for everything I did, and it's a good reminder of me. So maybe that's part of reflection. I have The Customer Comes Second, Put Your People First and Watch Them Kick Butt, and that's by Hal Rothenbluth and Diane McFerrin Peters. I have actually read that one in the past, but it's time to reread it. I think that it's an incredible book and teaches you all about culture. Then the other one is called A Speck in the Sea, and it's the story of survival and rescue about somebody who fell off a lobster boat out in Montauk, Long Island, and what went through their mind and what went through the mind of the person who was on the boat and went back and rescued them. And it's a fascinating true story, and I had the pleasure of meeting both individuals about a week or so ago.
Oh, wow.
I had the opportunity to ask them about it. So those are the two that are in my book, but probably both of them give you a little bit of insight into my reading habits.
Yeah, that's great. Well, Alan, this has been a real pleasure. I also publicly want to thank Dan Rutenberg for putting us together and getting this set up. So obviously you must know Dan. And,
yeah, all too well.
That's great. So thank you so much for your time. I really learned a lot today, and I appreciate you being on the show, and perhaps we can bring you back again someday and even dig deeper into this stuff. So thanks for your time.
Steve, it's my pleasure. I truly appreciate the opportunity, and I wish all of your listeners out there health and safety in this crazy world, and I wish you all the best.
Thanks, and same to you.
Bye now.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. To listen to all my interviews, subscribe to Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and many other popular podcast platforms. Some of these interviews are on video, and you can search YouTube for Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson. You can also access the entire library of interviews on my website, orange.coaching.com, and that is orange.coaching.com, and go to the Media Center and click on Podcasts or Video Gallery. You can also enter the website from pilpodcast.com.